So the title of the talk tonight is The Voices That Call Us. And it came from really quite a lot of notes, Takim on the board, that were really asking the right questions and interesting questions of questions like, wait a minute, if I'm with the body and not with my thoughts, then what about good thoughts that tell me about my life? What do I do with them? And questions about thinking and about life, really. So it's not such an easy subject. So I just want to say that with an atmosphere of inquiry, I'm not here to give some kind of packaged truth that we all have to believe in some way because somewhere there's a Buddha behind. It's really much more inquiry and the question. And so just in that atmosphere, just take some of the things I'm going to be talking about with a just touch them and see how they fall, how they land inside, and just touch them. So the first question I want to ask is also a difficult question, and the question is, what is it that's really driving our life? What's the engine that drives our life? I mean, where we go, how our directions, our decisions, our choices that we make, our fate. And usually we'll say, well, what's good for me is what I think. So clearly thought drives my life. I think I'm going to go and study university, so I go to study university. So thought is driving my life. But I think that you've had enough experience in 3 days together to realize that thought is a total mess. It's a chaos in the mind. So how from this chaos, is this chaos driving our life? The question, this grasshopper, this monkey that's hopping about in the mind, that's meant to tell me what I have to do in my life? And can I believe it? If Bemet, the mind says go there, this chaotic mind, do I believe it? And the mind, the thought tries to think of the future. If I go there, it'll be better for me. But that's also crazy. Can the thought say one word, really, about the future? We have any idea? So the thought itself, this chaotic thought, is trying to reach into the future and say, what will be? Impossible. So you say, it's not thought, it's my heart. My heart is driving me. I feel I want to. I don't feel like this. I feel in love. Or I don't like this. I'm not going in that direction. I love this person. I'm not going to get married to this one. I'm going to get married to the other one. My heart is telling me to go now to India, or come back from India, or go now to there, or go now to there, or do this, or do that, or I feel like. But the heart is even worse than the mind. It's changing every minute. It's coming and going. We see something small and we go crazy. We go, we're angry 1 minute and we're joyful and happy the next minute. Can we rely on the heart to tell us anything? So you say, okay, it's not the heart then. So what's driving me? Then it must be conditions that are driving me. I'm driving my life based on conditions. There's a certain condition of I grew up like that, I was in this house, I was in this situation, and therefore I'm like that. And I, like I, the piece that we read yesterday from my book of the conditions that make a tree go like this or go like that is the conditions of the wind and the water and the pruning, the gizum and whatever. So they're the conditions that make me go here, go there, go there. But the trouble with that is that the conditions are not us. They come from outside. So therefore, if it's conditions that control my life, then I'm just a leaf on the water, passive, just being controlled by, you know, Sandhya once said a nice quote, only dead fish go with the flow. Very nice one. So clearly we need, I think, to get closer to understand what is thought, to understand what the heart is doing with us, to understand a little bit conditions, although that's not the subject of this evening, but I'll mention it. But really get closer to what the thought is doing and how does it control us, or we control thought. And how does it all work, that this whole heart-mind that controls us and seemingly we can't control it. So first about thought. Indeed, it seems like we can't stop it. It seems like an endless stream. Many of us here thinking, well, I've been to a meditation retreat, so I should have more control over my thought. Isn't that what we're doing here? We're trying to kind of reduce the thought. Okay, next retreat. Wait a minute, there's a next retreat. Well, I should be able to stop my thought. No? Next retreat. Well, I've been through three retreats already. I should be able to stop my thought a little bit. Four retreat, five retreat, six retreat. Well, the thoughts are still coming like crazy, unstoppable. How? I've done six retreats already. What's happened? Why? Well, I'm just a total failure. The Dharma is useless. The whole thing doesn't work because I've just got a crazy amount of thoughts still happening. So clearly, they're very powerful noise in the mind. It's like full-on noise, and they dominate. And thoughts are very, very controlling, very strong. And obviously, you know, they are hugely powerful. We just think of any social thought. I like, you know, the example I have, again, from the 60s, is the Vietnam War. Because the Vietnam War, which killed 3 million people, Vietnamese, of course, mostly, was based on a thought called freedom, American thought, freedom. So let's bomb the hell out of Vietnamese for the sake of this freedom. Doesn't matter what, democracy, king, my country, their thoughts. So you can see how powerful they are, and they seem to be so real and so solid, and they give us no quiet at all. One of the most powerful talks of the Buddha, and in the tradition it's so powerful that 1,000 people that listened to him reached instant awakening. Mythology of the Dharma. But the most powerful is acknowledged to be the fire, the talk on fire, when he said, burning, 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 a human being is burning, burning with the senses, burning with the thought, burning with the mind, burning with reactions, responses, burning with thought, with conclusions, with perceptions, with feelings. The human being is burning, burning, burning. And a very powerful image. And although, you know, maybe it's strong for us to think like that, we don't feel it quite like that, but I think we can all feel there's something wild and uncontrollable going on, and we sit here for 45 minutes and sometimes we're bursting and we feel, wait a minute, the Buddha was not so far away, that there's something in me so non-quiet and so non-silent. The noise is endless, the noise of the mind, the noise of the heart, the body wants to move, the body hurts, the disturbances are there, the outside, inside, that, you know, there's a sense that the Buddha was right. So thoughts are intense, and partly they're intense because they're connected to survival. We want to think our way to survival. We want to think our way to a better future. We want things to be better. We want to understand the world so that we can survive better. We want to know what's going on. I don't know what we do to know, but 90% of the population read Yisrael Hayom in order to know what's going on. You just think of the amount of information that everybody's receiving every day in order to know what's going on, in order to be okay, in order to understand things, in order to predict what will happen, to order to make, to understand the future, to be okay tomorrow and make sure there's enough money and whatever tomorrow. So you can see the power of this. But thoughts are just forms in the consciousness. All they are is the consciousness packaged into a form or a picture. They're made of consciousness. And we don't see that we're doing that. So consciousness is kind of like the image I use, is like the ocean put into bottles. And we don't know that we do it. So all we see is the bottles, we don't see the ocean. And a lot of it, the power of thought, and why we don't see it, is the thought is a kind of packaged me. There's a me behind the thought. There's a self that's driving the thought process. I need, I want, I think, I must have, I have to. So all thoughts have in them a little self that's sitting there inside the thought and saying, here I am, here I am, here I am. And it gets crazy, this self. I mean, you can see what's happening in retreat. In the retreat, what happens is the silence and the practice gives space to the thought and to the self. And then what can happen? Someone takes our cup, the most silly thing, and we write 20 notes to the poor managers. And when we forget that, the poor managers, Orly and Sofnat, having to cope with 20 notes because someone took their cup. Why? Because it's blown up, because the thought and the self behind it, someone moves our cushion and we go crazy. And when, after the retreat, someone would say, well, you know, what's the problem? Someone moved my cushion. That's a problem. I don't understand. That's a problem. It's out of proportion. And it happens. It happens all the time because we give space to the craziness of the mind and we begin to see the craziness of the mind and the craziness of the heart and the craziness of the self. We begin to see the non-quiet that the Buddha talked about, because we give space to it, and it can be very problematic, and especially to managers of retreats. So we thought powerful, but they're packages that we don't see, that we've packaged a big consciousness into small packets, and then also thought drive our life, drive our action. There's this poem that I like to use, Theravada poem, that says, sow a thought, we reap a word, sow a word, we reap, mekatzer, kotzer, an action. Sow an action, we reap, kotzer, a habit. Sow a habit, and we reap a personality. Sow a personality, and we reap a fate, goral. So it starts with thought. Thought is the... In the Buddhist world, in the Eastern world altogether, not just Buddhist world, thought and heart are actually not two departments. They are one. And it's under one word, citta. Citta is heart, mind. And they go together. So we can hardly talk about thought without also talking about feeling. Because with every thought, there is a certain feeling. Thoughts are not just a computer that are totally neutral processing. There's always a feeling behind a thought, and there's usually a thought behind a feeling. So thoughts are driven by the heart. And just think about, why do you think a certain thought? It's because it's of interest. There's an interest in there. The self has an interest to go there. Or we're interested in this and not that. We're interested in the food on the plate in our dinner time. We're not interested in this amazing plate. It's just so white and it's just so interesting. The food, I don't need the food. The plate is so amazing and beautiful, and it's the food we want. So the mind is always going to where the heart is telling it that you should be interested in this and not this. And that constructs the mind. So the heart is driving the mind. Our choices. We have a pain in the body. And the heart begins. Oh, it hurts me. Then it begins to drive thought. Oh, it's a problem. Oh, my knees are hurting. I'm sitting here already half an hour with my knees hurting. Am I going to be crippled? Should I ask the managers to take me to hospital? How long do I need to practice with painful knees, which is the right method according to the Theravada guidebook? The mind is working with it. The mind is busy. The heart is driving something. There's unpleasantness. The heart picks it up, and the mind picks it up and begins to run with it, and run and run and run. And small feelings can create huge, huge result. A small feeling of, insult. Someone can insult us. Just a small word or a movement. Or like I say, pushing our chair. And it begins to grow and it grows in the mind and the building, and they don't like us and they've got to get them back. But grows and grows. And the heart itself is also driven by the thought. You just think of the example of jealousy. The thought that someone has something that I want, or the thought that my partner is talking to someone else in the pub over there. Wow. The heart starts to grow. Anger, jealousy. So heart and mind are all the time talking to each other. So let's think about what we can do with this. The first thing is that the Dharma isn't just about being an observer. The Dharma is about also being an engaged participator in our life and has a very strong teaching of what is harmonious, what is healthy, what is helpful. It's through and through the Dharma. And so in relation to thought, even though your instructions you've had in this retreat so far are basically to let thought alone and be more with the body, nevertheless, there is a lot of guidance in the Dharma about actually working and changing thought. And instead of the chaos and cacophonia, the cacophony of thought, to actually guide and change thought to thought that is more helpful. There is a lot of teaching about that. And it hasn't been possible to give this teaching in a 3-day retreat. But there's a lot of teaching on how to choose helpful thoughts. A helpful thought would be, I can let go something. I don't need to hang on to it. I don't need to build out of it a big story. That's a helpful thought. I can let it go is a helpful thought. I can trust myself or somebody else. It's a helpful thought. I have confidence is a helpful thought. I have love for myself or for others is a helpful thought. So anger is not a helpful thought. Negativity is not a helpful thought. And there is a way in which it still needs mindfulness. We cannot change thought without some mindfulness. So the basic tool that we're learning here is going to be used in every case. Because if we're not mindful, we don't know what our thought is saying. We don't even know what thought we have. We're just doing it in life. We're just acting our thoughts. We don't even know what our thoughts are saying. Mindfulness shows us what our thoughts are telling us. Then we have a possibility to begin to ask, is this thought helpful? Is this thought true and useful? And if not, I'm going to drop it. I'm not going down that road. I'm going to take another road. And we can do that. And I'm sure some of you have been doing it and know this. This road is not leading me to a helpful place. I'm going to choose another road. And every time we actually practice metta, loving kindness, we're doing that. We're dropping thoughts of selfishness, me, 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 and saying, no, I'm going to direct my mind towards kindness, towards another, towards the other, towards other beings, other people, even towards myself. Instead of negativity towards myself, I'm going to develop kindness to myself. This is a thought. So clearly we can design our thoughts to some extent. And we can also confront our thoughts. We can say, okay, I see my thought. I give it a name. One of the most useful practices in working with thought, especially thought that is really loop in the mind, and keeps nagging at machshavot tardaniyot. If we really have thoughts that are going on and on non-stop, we give them a name. Ah, judgmental thought, number 51. Judgmental thought, number 52, and it's only 8 o'clock in the morning. We give them a label. It's helpful. It helps us to step out a bit. And so that's one way in which we can confront thoughts and hold them. It's important that we understand one difference. Practice with thought is not, the word in English is rumination. In Hebrew, it's chafira, I think. Yeah, it's right? Me and Nechadim, yeah. Nechadim and Nechadot talk about it. So you know the language. But it's really, grinding, and practice with thought is not that. That tends to be a place of insecurity where we're endlessly thinking and thinking and thinking in order to kind of prevent something bad happening, or to know what the future is, or to work out a problem that we have. And it's endless Sisyphi to turn the something in. And often choices in life, we can give ourselves hell of weeks of asking, of trying to choose a direction. I go, Aleph or Bet, where am I going? And it's just like night after night and day after day, we just turn it in the mind. So it's not that. The awareness of thought is a sense of seeing thought like a movie, or like a picture, or like a word, or like music that is arriving and passing by. A word, an image, a package of consciousness that is passing by. And it passes fast. It's a package sent by Federal Express. There, whoosh. And the key to working with thought is non-identification, ihizdahut. That we can see thought as it passes, like the train coming into the station, we just let the train go out. We stand there and watch the train of thought going into the station and then leaving again. And we're still quietly sitting there on the platform, on our retsif, just taking our place calmly. If it's an Indian train, we're sitting there at least one day on the platform. I've been through that many times. And the train never comes, actually. Indian trains never come. But let's say, Rakevet Yisrael, we let the train come in the platform and we let it leave again. So the key to working with thought in our practice in Vipassana is recognizing thought, knowing it's there, allowing it to be there, not fighting it, seeing that it's a package that is in the mind, letting it come, letting it go, and that process giving it less domination over our entire existence. So the problem with thought is not that thought itself is a problem. The problem is that we have given it huge power over us. That's the problem. It's not a problem to have thought. I'm sure the Buddha was sitting there having thought now and then. So what? It doesn't have to be anything other. You can sit there quietly in deep samadhi and your tummy is saying something. It's a problem? No. So why have a problem with the mind saying something? It's no problem. The problem is that we put thought on the bummer, on the stage, it controls us, we're busy with it, and we forget everything else. Like I said in the walking meditation, we forgot we have a body, because all we're doing is thinking about walking to the supermarket. We don't know we have a body that's walking. We just have a thought in the mind, I want to buy milk. So the problem is the importance. So we can a little bit see the pain of that, see the need we have for story. We all need a story. We all need stories. We're all building stories about ourselves, writing scripts, tasritim, about us, about the future, about this. We see some pain in that. It is dukkha in that. And then slowly, slowly, we let the thought be less important. Let it be in background. Let it be there. We don't need to dance to every message, like Bubal Chutim, that every thought is is dominating our entire consciousness. So the thing is just to let thought be less interesting. So you can ask, and that's what some of the notes I've been getting, well, surely there's some important thoughts. I'm sitting here quietly. If I don't have insight, well, isn't it tovana, insight? And am I not having wonderful insights about what I'm going to do next week? And do I have to get rid of them as well? So I think, yes, it's fine to appreciate insight that we have. Yes, it's fine. It's like what I said before, directing thought, thought that's useful and helpful, no problem. But, we don't need it to control us. We can appreciate a thought that gives us an insight and let it go. So what sometimes happens is that people on retreat have an insight and then they really get into it. Oh, I know what I'm going to do next week and it's going to be amazing and I'm going to build a new project and I'm going to have this one come there and this is going to happen and that's going to happen. They build a whole world out there, and it's a little bit like, you know, you haven't got... It's spending the money in the bank before you've got it, really. You don't really have the money in the bank, savings, but immediately you spend it on nice ideas. And so we want to build more money in the bank. I mean, the image of building power rather than using it straight away. So I remember, you know, like 20 years ago, I was on a 3-month retreat in IMS in Massachusetts in America. And I was really, you know, I'm writing books. I write a lot of books, or I have written, and I am writing books. And I just wrote books in my mind, you know, all the time. I was endlessly writing books and books and books and books. And I went to the teacher, Joseph, and I said, I'm writing all these books and I can't stop. And he said, well, just remember that it's kind of pleasure. You're in a pleasure trip. It's like a masturbation. It's a pleasure. You're doing, giving yourself pleasure. Oh, my God. Let me do an exercise with all of you right now. Just... Let me stop for a moment, okay? Just take a breath, close your eyes, okay? Just take a moment, quiet. And feel ourselves sitting here together. Feel our body sitting. And the space in the room and the sounds. And begin to pay attention to what's going through the mind right now. What kind of thoughts are passing by? And give a little attention to them. What are they saying? First of all, are there many thoughts? Are there one thought chasing another? Like a chain of thoughts? Can we experience a chain of thoughts? And ask yourself a question. Are the thoughts that I'm thinking right now, Are they useful? Are they helpful? Mo'ilim, are they helpful? And if they're not particularly helpful, why are they there? How did they get there? Okay, you can take a breath and open the eyes. It's a small window in our mind, to our mind. So citta as mind, heart, we also need to understand the way the heart is driving the mind. And be aware that one of the reasons that thought seems so dominant, so consistent, the story goes round and round and round and round, and the stories come back, and they come back the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. And the reason is very often that the heart is driving the story, and there is behind the story a feeling. And very often the kind of feeling that is driving mind is anxiety. Anxiety is classic for the engine driving endless thought and lack of peace. So anxiety about what might happen, about what they will do, about what my family members are doing, or what my children, my husband, my wife, my close family members, my close friends, what do they want, what they don't want, what they like, what will happen to them, etc. Anxiety, just a small example. And we need to see that. Irritation is another one. Irritation, it's like atzbanut, and it goes into anger. Things are not working, things are not right, I don't like them this way, goes to irritation, atzbanut, and it goes to anger. Driving a lot of thought. So just be aware of that, and with compassion, again, not to criticize ourselves because of that, but just to notice that there's emotion driving the thought, and then focus on the emotion. Check it out. What is the feeling behind these thoughts, driving these thoughts, and go there, not to the thought. The feeling in the heart, the feeling in the body. Anxiety may be in the tummy, maybe in the chest, maybe in the throat, maybe in the breathing, we can feel it. Just go right to the anxiety that's driving thought, and then the thought will cool down. So, we didn't talk about this really in this retreat, but the work with the heart is very much part of our vipassana practice, Dharma mindfulness practice, and it really is about listening to the music of the heart. What is the heart saying all the time? It's very obvious if it's anxiety or anger, but it's also small things, interest, feeling of being up, feeling of being down, feeling of being more happy, feeling of being more sad, a feeling of loss, a feeling of enthusiasm, feeling of quietness, quiet heart, or feeling of love and appreciation, gratitude. So the heart is always talking. So part of the practice is to sit by the music of the heart, or to sit by the heart as a kind of, or the emotional life as a kind of river. And we just sit there listening to the music and the sound of the water. That's an image about listening to the music of the heart. And it's very much part of the practice. And it purifies the heart. so that we listen to the subtle feelings, the hargashot, the subtle feelings, our feeling life, our emotional intelligence, if you like. The heart is saying a lot, and mostly we shut it down. We're not listening, unless it's anger or super love. But we're talking now about constant stream of heart messages. And we can open that door, and it makes our life very rich. People sometimes say, oh, meditation is all adishut, is neutral, we're just sitting there kind of not this, not that, getting rid of thought, getting rid of feeling, getting rid of this, we're not at all. We're inviting, it's the actual opposite. We're inviting the whole thing. We're inviting us to be there with much, much more awareness of what's really going on in our being. And it's a good example of feeling life. We really, really touch feeling life that's flowing all the time, and we don't notice it usually. So a few words about working with thought and liberation. And we really can work with thought as a kind of doorway to freedom. Firstly, we begin to see where thought arises and where it goes. How thought arises from consciousness. That's already a big thing, that we see the way consciousness is actually packaging itself into a thought. The consciousness is the ocean, the thought is the wave. They're made of the same thing. A thought is made out of pure consciousness, but we don't notice the consciousness in the thought. We just notice the message. So if we get more close to thought, we also get more close to consciousness, awareness. And we can see it in different ways. Awareness, we can see it as light. We can see it as knowing. We can just see it as presence. We can see it or know it as sense of being alive. In many ways, we can hold pure consciousness in our awareness. But it's the practice of seeing the consciousness in its sort of formation of the ocean as it makes a wave. Made of the same stuff. Ocean and wave is made of water, same. But the way the ocean is made into a story called my, don't know what, whatever. And something in the deeper understanding sees that consciousness is constantly going out to grasp things in the world. Consciousness is making the world. We see the world through consciousness. The consciousness is making the world. I see people, I touch, I know, you all know. You know what you're seeing. You know objects, you know things, you know each other, you know yourself, you know your life. Who is doing that? What's doing that? That's consciousness. So consciousness is constantly going out and grasping the world and making forms. But itself is really free. It's free. Consciousness is like nothing. It's like water. But it just makes forms all the time. It's restless, making forms. It's not interested in the space in the room. It's interested in the objects in the room. The Buddha said it's a little bit like there's light in this room. We don't see light. We just see when light hits an object. If there was no objects in this room, we wouldn't see light. It's invisible. Don't see it passing. So just a thought about. So let me go back to the first question for a few minutes. How do we answer the question or relate to the question, what is driving our life if thoughts are so chaotic and crazy and the heart is so wild and the world is so unpredictable and uncontrollable. So what drives our life? And what are we going to do about that? And I think that we have to understand that as we grow more aware and awake, then we are more able to drive our life. That at the moment our life is driven by forces that we don't understand and we can't control them. The thought and the heart and the circumstances, nisibot, they are just doing what they like to us. But as we grow in awareness, our awareness becomes bigger, and then we have actually more power to say there, or there, or there. It needs consciousness to be able to say there. And so we can say more intuition, a bigger awareness, more understanding of the heart and the way what my heart is telling me. Because I'm listening to the heart, I can see where my heart is telling me and directing me and what's wise and what's not wise. I'm listening to the mind, I can see what the mind is saying is this is right, this is better, this is a helpful way, this is useful to me and to other people. The heart, I can say this is a compassion, I'm going there. I'm not listening to the other things. We need to know what the heart is saying to do that. So it's as we grow in awareness, we bring back control over our life, and we bring back our ability to use the powers of mind and heart to serve us and not just to control us like a puppet. These are powers. Power of mind is a huge power, but we lost it in crazy thought. We want to come bring back power. I know power is not a very dharmic word here, but capacity, call it capacity, qualities, echuyot, wisdom. So then if we do that, choices get easier. And it's true that conditions control us, yes. But conditions will, you know, a virus can come along and kill us. Hope not. At least not in this retreat. conditions. We're not in control. We're not in control of Trump. We're not in control. Conditions happen. Things happen. That's life. Things happen. So we're not in control, indeed. But we don't know how much we're not in control. And if we understand that, we realize that we're not in control, that's already winning back control. We have a mind that knows these things. And we can say, yes, I'm formed and directed by circumstances which I don't control. But I know it. And I can act. So we win back, in a way, control of our life if we become very wise and intimate and aware of what's going through our mind, what's going through our heart, and what's happening to us in our life. We just need to expand those capacities of wisdom, awareness, heartfulness, connectedness with everything. And then we find we come back to, in a way, control of our life. Or direct our life. Thank you.